From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. She's back. Sarah Palin hands her endorsement to Donald Trump as only she can.
He is from the private sector, not a politician. Can I get a hallelujah?
Michigan Governor Rick Snyder apologizes for the disaster in Flint.
To you, the people of Flint, I say tonight, as I have before, I am sorry and I will fix it.
Iran releases five American prisoners, including U.S. Marine Amir Hekmati.
As soon as we got out of Iranian airspace, the champagne bottles were popped, and the Swiss are amazing, their hospitality. Chocolates, veal was served.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Michael Crowley from Politico, Amy Walzer from the Cook Political Report, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online. Does Sarah Palin's endorsement help or hurt Trump? Does Hillary Clinton now have an uphill battle against Bernie Sanders? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me from Washington is Michael Crowley, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Michael, welcome back to On Point.
Great to be back.
Also from Washington, Amy Walzer joins us, national editor at the Cook Political Report. Amy, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you very much.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Jane, Michael, and Amy.
Amy and Michael, you've got your snowshoes on, ready for the blizzard coming your way. Really good to have you despite the storm. Thank you.
I'm up here in my bathing suit. Beautiful in New Hampshire.
Let's get to big week in politics with just 10 days to go before the Iowa caucuses. Let's start on the GOP side first. Amy, Trump versus Cruz, is that what it's coming down to?
Well, this is really taking an interesting turn because for the last couple of weeks now, the assumption has been this is a two-man race between Cruz and Trump, and yet they've really sort of stayed away from engaging each other, as traditionally happens in a competitive race. However, it looks like that veil has been lifted, and today we see Donald Trump going up with a very significant attack on Ted Cruz and his somewhat fumbling answer on whether or not he supported a legal immigration back in 2013. And it's a 60-second spot. Ted Cruz up with his own attack ads. And this is probably good news for the so-called establishment candidates, Marco Rubio, Chris Christie, the other candidates who are trying to break through, who haven't had a chance to do that. As the two front runners engage each other, perhaps a chance that they start to get an opening to break through. But it will be fascinating to see where this fight leads and whether or not it continues when we have the last debate before the caucuses, which is on January 28th, a Fox-sponsored debate in Des Moines.
Well, of course, this week, Sarah Palin as well, jumping in here, the 2008 Republican vice presidential candidate, former governor of Alaska, and certainly Tea Party favorite, endorsing Donald Trump this week. Here's that.
Well, Trump, what he's been able to do, which is really ticking people off, which I'm glad about, he's going rogue left and right, man. That's why he's doing so well. He's been able to tear the veil off this idea of the system, the way that the system really works. And please hear me on this.
Michael Crowley, does this endorsement help Trump in Iowa?
You know, I think that my analysis of it is that it helps Trump more in the sense of the attention that it draws and the way – I mean, the genius of Trump is his ability to always be on the front page, in the soundbite, dominating the top of the TV news. So will there be a large number of voters who were not sold on Donald Trump yet who say, okay, now that he has Sarah Palin's blessing, I'm with him? You know, I think that number is probably somewhat limited. But the fact is that it's a, you know, that event was a media sensation and people are kind of fascinated, some genuinely, somewhat, some perversely, by Sarah Palin. And it, to me, is just another instance where Trump has a genius for the big stage and the spotlight and, you know, was able to pull off this great theatrical stunt almost that has us talking about him and continues to make it impossible for the other candidates, with the exception to some degree of Ted Cruz, to break through, to make their argument, to get people to look at them. It's sort of a great big look at me, look at this wild and weird thing. So does it translate on the ground in terms of foot soldiers, bringing people into his camp who weren't there? I'm not sure, but I do know that it continues to suck up the oxygen and make it really hard for other candidates to get momentum.
Jack Beatty, what do you think? What does the Palin endorsement mean for the GOP electorate, more broadly speaking, not just in Iowa?
Well, you know, first, Gail Collins, the columnist for The Times, really, writers should look at her for the art of understatement. She said about Palin, "I think it's safe to say there hasn't been a whole lot of personal growth." And yet when you descend into that word salad that she emitted for Trump, you find a gem of a sentence that I think lights up the whole passion of the Republican electorate. She said, "We are mad because we've been had." And they've been had by their own establishment. One early poll showed something like 80% of Republican voters feel betrayed by their own electors, politicians in Washington, who overpromised, who said, "Well, we'll have Obama's head on a pike, we'll suspend, get rid of all the regulation and fix everything." Of course, there was a little barrier in the way there, the Constitution, but the president is still in office, he can veto things. But that was left out by the Republican campaigners, and so there's just a fury in the Republican base. We've been mad because we've been had. Mm.
You mentioned the Republican establishment. Here's a Republican presidential candidate and Senator Ted Cruz on Tuesday in Iowa attacking the Republican establishment.
"It is no surprise that the establishment is in full panic mode. We said from the beginning that the Washington cartel was going to panic more and more as conservatives unite behind our campaign."
Jack, you've mentioned to me a sort of parallel panic, if you will, of both parties with the prospect of Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders coming out winners in Iowa.
It really is something. I mean, the panic on the Republican side almost gets to Edvard Munch-like panic, you know, full-throated no. And, you know, listen to some of this stuff. Richard Burr, Republican senator from North Carolina, was quoted as saying in a fundraising group that he had to choose on the ballot between Ted Cruz, a colleague, and Bernie Sanders, the Democratic Socialist. He'd vote for Sanders. We have Bob Dole saying, "Oh, my God, you put that guy Cruz on our ticket. It'll be cataclysmic down the ballot." On the other hand, you have the National Review saying, "Stop Trump," in a special issue. And you've got Lindsey Graham saying, "A pox on both houses." He says, "Well, Cruz v. Trump, it's like being shot versus being poisoned." This is unprecedented. Yet you go to the Democrats, and there you've got a different kind of a sort of modified, limited freakout. You've got people, you know, saying Democratic Socialist. One Tennessee congressman told the Times it wouldn't be helpful outside Vermont, Massachusetts, Berkeley, Palo Alto, and Ann Arbor. Another said Hillary Clinton doesn't have to explain socialism to suburban voters. On the other hand, you've got Bernie Sanders getting 7,000 people in a rally in Birmingham, Alabama. You've got him putting up 50 paid staffers apiece in North Carolina and South Carolina. You've got money pouring in. And you've got in on the ground in Iowa, it was a desolating piece for Hillary Clinton people in the Times yesterday, a portrait of a demon canvasser, famous woman who's brought home more voters than anybody else in Iowa, she's going at 0 degrees, walking around in Newton, Iowa. She out of 34 voters, something like 27 voters, she gets two committed to Clinton and finds a sort of glacial, oh my gosh, we just don't feel any enthusiasm.
Well, let me play some sound here from the Sunday night Democratic debate. NBC moderator Lester Holt pointed out that Hillary Clinton is actually beating Bernie Sanders more than 2-1 among minority voters. And he asked Sanders how he expected to win the nomination without the support of African Americans.
"When the African American community becomes familiar with my congressional record and with our agenda and with our views on the economy and criminal justice, just as the general population has become more supportive, so will the African American community. We have the momentum. We're on a path toward victory."
Amy Walter Clinton tied herself closely to Barack Obama, defending Obamacare, defending his actions in Syria. Is this a winning strategy for her at this point?
Well, certainly that has been the strategy all along, is I'm the closest thing to the Obama legacy that you're going to get. And there are two reasons for this. One, as you pointed out, you know, her real firewall, if you want to call it that, for winning the nomination is the fact that she runs very well among minority voters. It's African-American and Latino. In 2008, she did well among the same groups that she's doing well among now: women, more traditional Democrats, more conservative Democrats, blue-collar Democrats, and Latinos. But of course, she lost African-American voters and liberals pretty significantly. Now what she's hoping to do is to win by using that same delegate strategy, but running well with African-Americans, especially not just in the South, but even in big states in the Northeast and the Midwest, like Ohio and Illinois. The challenge for Bernie Sanders is that he's just not particularly well known in that community. He does have a great story to tell beyond his congressional record. If you listen to his experiences as a young college student, beyond just doing work with the civil rights movement, he, as a student at University of Chicago, actually led the fight to integrate housing at the school as like a 19 or 20 year old. So, you know, he's been part of the fight and part of the movement for quite some time. He's just not particularly well known. It's also not a talking point of his. I mean, this has been the real challenge if you want to talk about a Bernie Sanders as a candidate versus Bernie Sanders as a messenger. He has a fantastic message about the economy being rigged that resonates very immediately with voters. But ask him to expand that into other issues, and there's a little bit of a struggle there. He doesn't like to be able to do that. I don't know how comfortable he is doing that.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about the week in the news this hour, and you can join the conversation. Do you see the landscape changing much in the next 10 days before Iowa? Are you optimistic that we've turned the corner with Iran? We're speaking this hour with Amy Walter from the Cook Political Report, Michael Crowley from Politico, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Here's a bit from the campaign stop in New Hampshire on Monday. Texas Senator and presidential candidate Ted Cruz questioning Donald Trump's ties to Democrats and previous support for liberal positions.
Mr. Trump enthusiastically supported President Obama's stimulus plan and said the only problem was it should have been bigger. I don't think we should have a massive payoff to lobbyists from taxpayers. And if you want to turn around the debt, you've got to demonstrate that you are willing to stand up to that cronyism.
And at Sunday night's Democratic debate, Hillary Clinton went after Bernie Sanders on health care and on his pragmatism. She said he is for a single-payer health care system, something that she says is just not feasible in today's political realities in this country.
Even when the Democrats were in charge of the Congress, we couldn't get the votes for that. So what I'm saying is really simple. This has been the fight of the Democratic Party for decades. We have the Affordable Care Act. Let's make it work.
Hillary Clinton, Michael Crowley, has been criticizing Bernie Sanders for being a self-proclaimed socialist and arguing that many of his progressive policies are just unrealistic. What do you make of that argument, that strategy?
It's excuse me. It's one of many ways in which I think there are ominous echoes for Hillary Clinton of the 2008 campaign, her primary fight against Barack Obama. Now, I assess Bernie Sanders as a significantly smaller threat to her than Obama was at this time, although still a real one. But there are some disturbing parallels. You know, I've seen both Hillary and Bill Clinton make their pitch, and a lot of it involves the idea that the opponent, in this case Sanders, in that case Obama, is promising, you know, sweeping change that simply isn't realistic. And boy, wouldn't it be nice if we could have everything we wanted on the progressive Democratic wish list, but it's just not possible. And it's about getting things done. And she, Hillary Clinton, has the experience in the trenches, you know, sometimes working with Republicans if necessary to get these things done. I saw Bill Clinton pointing out that he believes she is the more electable candidate in the general election. You know, these are all arguments that she made against Barack Obama in 2008, and they fell flat. I think they are the logical, you know, wise arguments for her to be making. But the problem is that when you have a candidate who has a lot of momentum and excitement and is kind of, although Bernie's been around for a long time, in a sense, he's new to a lot of people, kind of a fresh new face. That is a very hard thing to beat back. And I just think she's got to be sweating right now, particularly given the memories of 08.
Let's go to Jenny, who is in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, right in the middle of it. Jenny, welcome to On Point. Glad you called.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that I think momentum is increasing for Hillary Clinton from the people I see. I was originally going to caucus for Bernie and went to his rally and just have shifted in the last week, and I'm going to caucus for Hillary. And I see that happening among a lot of my friends. I was thinking about what I want my Republican friends to do, and I would like them to caucus with their head, not their heart. And so I've decided to do the same.
All right, Jenny, thank you so much. Let's go to John in Boston. Hi, John. Glad you called. Welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, good. Go ahead.
I'm a Ted Cruz supporter because I think he's a real deal. I mean, Donald Trump supported de Blasio. He supported Hillary. He made fun of Ben Carson for having a religious conversion, which I thought was really bad taste. And the media tends to, like, enable Donald Trump. And I think that Donald Trump would lose to Bernie Sanders or Hillary. And I think what would be ideal is to have Ted Cruz and Rand Paul versus Bernie Sanders, because it would be like Barry Goldwater versus JFK if JFK happened to live.
All right, John, I hear it. Not sure about that, but we'll see. I'll go to one more here in Iowa, Iowa Falls. Here's Keith calling. Welcome, Keith. Glad you called.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, I'm calling because I want to say why I'm going to be supporting Bernie in the caucuses.
Okay.
Looking back at the records, we can see that there were three big votes, and they've been a few years ago. But one was the war in Iraq. Okay. Huge mistake. Bernie voted against it. Hillary voted for it. The Patriot Act. Okay. Hillary was for that. Bernie voted against it. And finally, the Wall Street bailout. Again, Bernie voted against it. Hillary voted for it. To me, the record is clear. Three big chances to make a big decision. And Bernie came down on the right side.
And you're looking at history. Keith, thank you very much for the call. Let me play some more sound here. First, today, an ad released by, actually, that features Barbara Bush defending her son Jeb and taking a swipe at Donald Trump's ego.
Jeb has been a very good father, a wonderful son. A hard worker, his heart is big. When push comes to shove, people are going to realize Jeb has real solutions rather than talking about how popular they are, how great they are.
Amy, what chance is left for this one-time favorite and really fundraising front-runner, Jeb Bush?
Yeah, it is really an interesting study, the Jeb Bush campaign, what was the Jeb Bush juggernaut at one point. Look, I think from the very beginning of this race that the Jeb campaign and many others, quite frankly, in this lane really missed what was going on with the Republican electorate. It is a Republican electorate that wants change. They're not interested in experience. They're not interested in how much time they've spent, even successfully, in government. And Jeb decided to double down on experience, and that was exactly the wrong message. And then, of course, he got caught up in Donald Trump's crosshairs and came out on the losing end of the fight with Donald Trump. But fundamentally, as I said, I think that at the end of the day, this is a Republican electorate, much like what the Democratic electorate looked like in 2008, really primed for a change candidate. That doesn't mean it has to be Donald Trump, but it does mean that whoever wants to win the nomination has to prove themselves worthy of being a change candidate, not running as somebody who has been part of this system and is going to work within the system. That's also John Kasich's message as well, the governor of Ohio, which is why I don't think he's resonating particularly well.
Well, he seems to be, though, in New Hampshire. He's in second place in six recent New Hampshire polls behind Donald Trump. Here's some sound of him on Wednesday saying that his moderate message has hit home in New Hampshire.
The problems that we have in this country are not that difficult to solve. The thing that's hard to solve is the overpartisanship, the fact that people are not putting the country first or acting as representatives to America rather than to their party or their strident ideology.
Michael Crowley, what is this late Kasich surge? Are these the establishment GOP voters, or is this something else?
Well, I think New Hampshire is as fertile ground as John Kasich is going to find. You know, Kasich, there's always in the Republican field a moderate to liberal Republican. I don't know if he qualifies as liberal, but certainly to the left of the center of the party. And, you know, New Hampshire voters have long welcomed that. Somebody who's a little bit contrarian, heterodox, independent seeming. You know, of course, it was a place where John McCain had so much success. And I think that there's, you know, a small Kasich surge happening there because there's always a very receptive audience for the kind of message he's preaching, but we're not really seeing it nationally. And he has really, you know, focused all his time and attention on this one state. So I'm skeptical that it's transferable elsewhere. Although, having said that, you know, I think the Kasich campaign's theory is, I mean, what he often says is he doesn't need to win New Hampshire. He needs to be the story. He needs to be the one people are talking about. So I think his idea is he can surprise people and kind of wake up the media and wake up the Republican electorate and say, hey, this guy who we'd kind of written off, who's, you know, so low in the polls, really did better than we thought he would in New Hampshire. And that's interesting. Let's take another look. He can translate that into some momentum. But again, I think, you know, New Hampshire is one of the most welcoming states he's going to find. And I just, sorry to say for him, I'm skeptical that it's going to translate, given everything else we know about an electorate that's swarming to people like Donald Trump, Ted Cruz, Ben Carson, and the like.
Jack Beatty, wrap us up here. Who has the best ground game in Iowa? 10 days before the caucuses, what do you see?
Well, it's interesting that apparently Trump has the worst ground game. A week or so ago, the Times ran an expose. Basically said there are, you know, a man and a boy were running one plant, and they had an old dog in someplace else, and, you know, they were going to go out and do what they could. It sounded pretty slapdash, and yet it's all about organization there. So unless the Palin thing has really hurt Ted Cruz, you've got to say that he's got a dormitory, actually, for his out-of-state people who are staying, working for him. He's got things wired up and organized. So if it's a ground game, it looks like it's going to be good for him. On the other hand, the governor of Iowa came out and said, hey, this guy Ted Cruz is poison for us. He's against the ethanol subsidy. He's in the pocket of big oil. Don't vote for him. Now, is that going to hurt? We don't know. But it didn't sound a week ago as if Trump had much going on the ground.
Mm. All right, Jack, thank you. Let's move on to Iran now. Michael Crowley, two big stories this week with regard to Iran. Five American prisoners held there, including the Washington Post reporter, released. And President Obama's nuclear deal is a fact now on the ground. You wrote about this in Politico this week. Are these two events connected, would you say?
Well, officially, they're not connected. And Obama administration officials are very careful to say that the prisoners were not part of the year and a half or so of negotiations over Iran's nuclear program, and that, you know, they made no concessions on the nuclear issue to have the Americans released. I think the reality is, you know, these things were happening on kind of parallel tracks, and there's no sense in pretending that, you know, the context didn't commingle in a kind of way in this context of a diplomatic channel opening, a sense that these two countries could do business with each other right now. There's a moment where you have some, you know, relatively reformist, you have a relatively reformist president in a country that's otherwise, whose government is populated by hardliners. So I think the two things kind of happened in tandem, even though the official line is that they weren't directly connected.
Mm-hmm. You've written this week about the implementation day, as it's being called, in Iran. Here's a bit from President Obama saying that Iran's completion of key commitments under the nuclear deal was a good day, quote, and a milestone.
The bottom line is this. Whereas Iran was steadily expanding its nuclear program, we have now cut off every single path that Iran could have used to build a bomb.
Michael, you say that managing the deal's aftermath could be nearly as hard as the process of striking the deal in the first place.
Well, Iran is a very difficult and fascinating country. I mean, I think of it as being a little bit schizophrenic, a country with a kind of split personality. And so the nuclear deal and the prisoner exchange, you know, was the fruit of Obama's communications and diplomacy with, again, I mentioned a kind of reformist president, his foreign minister, Hassan Rouhani, is the president elected in June of, I think it was 2013, and his foreign minister, Javad Zarif, who negotiated the nuclear deal with John Kerry. And their allies in Iran's fractious political system do seem interested in having healthier relations with the United States, reducing this 36 years now of hostility since the 1979 Iranian Revolution. But at the same time, Iranian society and its government is populated by very hardline elements in the military, in the clerical establishment. The supreme leader himself still talks about the United States as essentially an enemy who cannot be trusted. So we have this deal, we have this prisoner exchange, some corks have been popped at the White House, but looking forward, you know, there are a lot of things that can still go wrong. And indeed, you know, many analysts who know a lot about Iran say that the nuclear deal could cause the hardliners to sort of act up, to assert themselves, to provoke incidents, to show that Iran is not bowing down before the United States, that the fight, the struggle against the longtime enemy is still there. You know, some analysts say that the hardliners need confrontation to justify and defend their grip on power and to distract from problems at home. So I think that there are many problems yet to come, and it's going to be a real balancing act to defend the deal and to preserve this diplomatic momentum Obama has started.
Let's get a call in here from Ron in Somerville. Ron, you're on the air. Welcome to On Point.
Yes, hi. You're talking about the release of the hostages. It was either Ted Cruz or one of the other candidates was saying that we gave them billions of dollars and we got nothing for it. And if they had been in charge, they would have forced the release of the hostages with the mighty pulpit of the presidential office or the military.
Yeah.
And it's just laughable. I mean, it really is laughable to think that the same old tired solutions would have worked with Iran. They were against the nuclear deal just because Obama formed it. It was a good deal. And as usual, they provide no solutions to their attack and rhetoric against Obama.
Yep. So you see the politics behind this. Michael Crowley, I hear you wanting to get in here. Let me play some sound here. NBC News Foreign Affairs correspondent Richard Engel was in Tehran this week reporting on the Iranian people's reaction to all of this that happened, especially implementation day. He spoke to an Iranian stock trader about her economic optimism.
I went to run to the work these days, you know.
Salehi invited us to her home, where we learned she has a degree in physics and is addicted to Game of Thrones.
The doors are open for everyone to come and invest, and everyone are welcome.
So we've got the hostages, we've got optimism in Iran about what's ahead. What do you see, Michael? Is this, got a financial windfall that Iran is going to receive here pretty quickly?
Yes, Iran is going to get $100 billion right away in unfrozen assets, and tremendous numbers of sanctions on its economy are going to be lifted. And I think a huge question is, what will be the effect on Iran's economy? And what does Iran do with that money? Do the hardliners use it to stir up trouble other places in the Middle East and to take a more aggressive posture? Or does a booming economy empower cosmopolitan moderates and steer the country's society in a more tolerant, moderate direction, which is, to some degree, President Obama's bet?
This On Point podcast is made possible by Squarespace. If you have a passion that you obsess over, if it keeps you up at night, if you live for it, you should show it off. With easy-to-use tools and templates, Squarespace websites help you capture every detail of what drives you. Because if it's worth the effort, it's worth showing to the world. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com. When you're ready to purchase, use the one-word offer code ONPOINT to save 10%. You should. Squarespace.
Hi, it's Tom with a quick heads up for you. Be sure to stay with us to the end of this podcast for a sneak preview of Modern Love. It's WBUR's new podcast put together in collaboration with the New York Times. You may want to check it out. Thanks.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. In other news this week, a boycott at the Oscars. Actress Jada Pinkett Smith asks, where is the diversity?
I ask the question, have we now come to a new time and place where we recognize that we can no longer beg for the love, acknowledgement, or respect of any group?
Researchers at the California Institute of Technology find evidence of a ninth planet in our solar system. Here is astronomer Mike Brown.
My jaw hit the floor. That just came out of the blue.
And the great Eagles guitarist Glenn Frey died this week at the age of 67.
Take it easy, take it easy. Don't let the sound of your own wheels drive you crazy.
You can join the conversation, listeners. Are these wild swings in the markets giving you the jitters? We're speaking this hour with Amy Walter, national editor for the Cook Political Report, Michael Crowley, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Just to put a button here on Iran, Jack, it's been a tense but successful, I guess, few weeks of U.S.-Iranian relationships. These sailors held and then freed, the prisoner swap, the lifting of sanctions. Is this a new era, would you say, in U.S.-Iranian relations?
Well, that's the promise of it, but that's well down the road. Personal relations go far in international affairs, and Secretary Kerry has a wonderful relationship, apparently, with his opposite number in Tehran. But, you know, where would we be if we hadn't reached this deal? This week, Graham Allison, the Harvard strategist, sort of did a counterfactual, and he says, well, if we hadn't reached the agreement, the international sanctions regime would almost certainly have broken down because the other countries involved, Russia, China, India, and so on, would have said the United States simply can't deliver. We're going to go back to trading. So Iran would be back into the world economy. Second, Iran would have restarted the activity it had frozen during its negotiations of nuclear enrichment, and that it would have cut the, quote, breakout time, the time needed to produce enough nuclear material for one weapon, from 2 months, where it had been frozen, to a week or closer. And finally, the world would have been much, because of this rapid breakout of Iran, would have been much closer to war with Iran than at any time in years. So that's where we would have been if we hadn't reached this deal, according to Graham Allison.
Thank you all for that. I want to move on to Flint, Michigan, because the Michigan Governor Rick Snyder issued a sweeping apology this week to the residents of Flint for the lead in their water. Here's some sound from Wednesday. Michigan Governor Rick Snyder telling CBS News Scott Pelley after repeated questioning that he did not know how much lead is still in Flint's water.
I don't understand why you can't give us the latest testing data and what it shows for the water in Flint. What is the number?
I don't have the number at the top of my head of the very latest data, and it varies by parts of the city.
I would think that the governor of Michigan would have those numbers at the top of his mind right now.
Amy Walter, a lot of people asking this week why it took the governor so long to respond to this.
Yeah, and as we learn more, we see that it's not a crisis that happened overnight, but one of those, and I don't mean this to sound poorly chosen word here, but it was more like a drip, where, you know, over time, what we see is that there were calls from people who were in the community, about this problem. We have a professor from Virginia Tech who alerted the government to these high levels of lead and other problems with the water, including toxic substances there. So this is something that was unfolding over the course of a year. And what it looks like happened, as we're now starting to see emails get released between the government officials and the governor's office and others, is that this was a community that was basically, if not ignored, was their concerns were belittled and not taken particularly seriously. And when they tried to fix some of the problems, it was really just a patch rather than full-on intervention in what is obviously a significant, significant health problem. I think it's also been – you have a governor right now. It's two-term governor, Republican Governor Snyder, who has double challenges, right? He has Detroit and its crumbling infrastructure, right. Crumbling school system, and now a crisis in Flint. This is a state that obviously was at one point one of the most robust, both economically and population-wise. Now, of course, is just struggling to stay afloat. And you can see that this governor really trying to juggle so many things at once and obviously failed spectacularly to the people of Flint.
Here's Hillary Clinton this week saying that the poor, majority African-American city of Flint, Michigan, was ignored by Republican Governor Rick Snyder when they raised concerns about lead in their drinking and bathing water.
The governor of that state acted as though he didn't really care if the kids in a rich suburb of Detroit had been drinking contaminated water and being bathed in it, there would have been action.
Chuck Beatty, can Governor Snyder survive this?
he seems stunned in that Scott Pelley report. That was just an embarrassing moment. You know, Flint is suffering from many things, an indifferent government, but also a failure of democracy. The governor had appointed an emergency financial manager because Flint was in dire straits to run the city as a dictator. And even after the city council voted to switch back to the Detroit water supply, and the people were complaining about the water they were getting from the Flint River. Even after that, the emergency manager said, no, we're going to stay with this. And there was no accountability for him. He was appointed. Democracy had been suspended in Flint. And this is a paradigm of what happens, perhaps the Detroit schools or another, when in the name of financial probity, a governor of one party takes over a city or an institution within a city full of people of the other party and essentially says, here's what's going to happen. Well, here's what did happen in Flint. Signals were missed, and the emergency manager, who had no pressure on him from the electorate, just went along his way, made the decision for $5 million. That's what this was about. We'll switch the water supply to save $5 million. Golly, they're going to be billions fixing it.
Let's turn to the economy for a moment. Here's CNBC's Kelly Evans on Wednesday reporting on the day's remarkable market volatility, where the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped over 500 points before recovering a bit and closing with a loss of about 249 points.
Look at that, a wild start to the year for the market, but nothing compares to today's action. The Dow under pressure all morning, that low of 565 just before 1 p.m., and then the blue chip index began a slow and steady reversal until around 3 p.m. That's when we saw a big comeback in the final hour of trading.
Michael Crowley, stock market's taken a beating lately. What's at the heart of this?
I think there are several factors converging, and by the way, I would note that there are all kinds of ominous echoes of 2008 afoot. You know, Sarah Palin is on the campaign trail and Bill Clinton is saying Hillary Clinton's opponent is naive and she's the most electable, and now the stock market has been crashing and it feels like 2008 all again. It's a little eerie. But in this case, I think on a serious note, it's not 2008 again in economic terms. You know, the financial system, I think, is stronger. The good news is that in the U.S., financial reforms have deleveraged the banks. They have a much higher ratio of capital in their reserves. But what we're seeing is the strain that comes from largely a slowdown of growth in China, which I think a lot of economists are nervous about. China's economy is slowing, and I think one fear is that it may be slowing faster than the Chinese are letting on. Not everyone completely trusts the public data that China releases. So China says that they're now at about, I think it's a 6.9 growth rate. There are people who are concerned it's slower, and although that would be a high number, that's a number that most countries would envy, given the demands of China's population and the way its economy is set up right now, it's actually not that impressive. There have also been some issues with the way China has managed its currency and its stock market that I think have shaken confidence in the Chinese government's ability to sort of keep things together. I mean, there's a fear that if China starts to fall apart, it's going to be spectacular. It's going to be a big boom in the world economy. Finally, oil prices are dropping. I think that's also related to predictions about Chinese growth. Oil is really plummeting. That scrambles a lot of assumptions. But the fundamentals, I mean, to use a cliche from 2008, the fundamentals of the U.S. economy look pretty sound. Job growth has been pretty good. So again, I don't think we're on the verge of a global world panic and recession, but there is a lot of anxiety in the air.
So, Amy, a slowing economy in China, low global oil prices. Can the U.S. insulate its markets? I mean, are we looking at a potential bear market? Michael doesn't seem to think so. What do you say?
I am not an economist, but in talking to people who do study this, I don't think they think it's going to be nearly as bad as it was in 2008. But look, it adds to the growing anxiety that many voters have in this country about the sort of stagnation that they've seen, whether it's in their overall household income, whether it's in their paychecks, the sense that things are off track and they're not going to get better at any time soon. And this is the environment in which if Hillary Clinton is the nominee or the Democratic nominee is going to have to grapple with, which is 8 years we've had President Obama, and it is now his economy, and it is going to be up to Democrats to make the case that despite the fact that people still feel like they are struggling, the fact that whether the stock market rebounds in time or not, that people feel as if they are barely keeping afloat, you know, is it time to change parties? Is it time for a new voice in the White House, a new party in the White House? And, you know, you see the candidates sort of struggling with this on the trail. For Hillary Clinton, all the work she's doing to tie herself to the president, she also notes that, you know, the economy is still not working for everybody. Obviously, Bernie Sanders talking about a rigged economy. These are not the words that you normally hear from the party in office, the current incumbent party, as signs of confidence in their own party's leadership. So, you know, normally when you're trying to succeed the person in office from your party, you say, aren't they great? Isn't it a great job? We want to stay the course, move forward. Let's go, America. That's obviously what you heard of when Al Gore was trying to succeed Bill Clinton. That's not what we're getting today.
Let me turn for a moment to the U.S. Supreme Court, which said this week that it would consider a legal challenge to President Obama's overhaul of the nation's immigration rules. It agreed to examine the reach of presidential power as it decides the fate of one of Obama's most far-reaching executive actions. Jack, good news for the Obama administration or not?
Well, the Obama administration asked for an accelerated judgment on this, and that'll be coming, I guess, in June, right at the height of the campaign. And if it goes against the administration, Hillary Clinton will exploit it and say, well, here's why you better elect me to the Supreme Court, because I'll see to it that immigrants get a better deal, and we'll get better justices and so on. And the Republicans, if it goes the other way, the Republicans will have a great issue. But you know, just on the merits of it, I'm struck by the dissent, Judge Carolyn King in the Fifth Circuit. The Fifth Circuit basically allowed the case to go to the Supreme Court by 2-1. They said that they agreed with the stay on the immigration executive order, but the dissenter, Judge Carolyn King, wrote that the argument that made by the majority on that court appears to allow limitless state intrusion into exclusively federal matters, effectively enabling the states through the courts to second-guess federal policy decisions, meaning that any time a state objects, as the state of Texas and 25 others did, to a federal policy, they could then sue and say, "Well, we object." And so it looks like the whole issue of standing for the states seems to me to be in question. Although the court has settled that they do have standing, but there is this idea that if it's decided against the government, the state governments are going to have tremendous leverage over federal decisions. Mm.
Just a couple of minutes here. I want to wrap up with the uproar about the lack of diversity in the Oscar nominations this year. A lot of talk about that this week. No minority actors were nominated for a second consecutive year. Amy Walter, what do you make of this?
Look, I think it goes to a more fundamental issue, too, and the sort of disconnect sometimes between what Hollywood and the folks in the industry see as things that they would like to highlight and the rest of America. And I think they don't necessarily see themselves as being the ones who are supposed to make these changes. But ultimately, if film is supposed to reflect the reality of America, and the best films are the ones that Americans can relate to, that they can support, then I do think that we're going to need to see that reflected in the people who get nominations, and also, quite frankly, in the people that make the films. We also know that there are fewer women directors. We also know that women get paid less than their male counterparts. We know that minorities are not offered the same parts that white actors are. So it's a change that's being demanded across all different parts of the American culture, and should be demanded in this one as well.
It looks like there's going to be an immediate return to a 10-film field of Best Picture nominees, at the very least. Michael Crowley.
Jack, go ahead. I was going to say, it gives the joke that Neil Patrick Harris told last year, New Point. He said, "Tonight we celebrate Hollywood's best and whitest. Brightest.
Mm-hmm. Well, on that note, I say thank you to our panel this hour. Amy Walter from the Cook Political Report. Really great to have you, Amy. Thank you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Michael Crowley from Politico. Thanks to you.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having
you.
Me.
Michael, Amy, stay warm down there. And On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, thanks to you.
Thank you.
Can continue the conversation, listeners. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up on Monday, Detroit has missed the boat before, but says this time it will not let Silicon Valley beat it to the car of the future. It's rolling out big ideas and big designs. We'll look at that coming up on Monday. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. Have a good weekend. This is On Point.
Let's face it, when have you ever been in a relationship that's gone as planned?
Sometimes I think about the vows my wife and I made to each other 28 years ago, and we're different people than we once were.
"And I don't even like him," I said, wiping my tears. "He's a liar. I can't spend the rest of my life with him."
Being wheeled into surgery like this, alongside a woman in a sexy dress, pretty much screamed sex injury.
Modern Love, popular New York Times column, is coming to you as a podcast.
There is no good way to tell a new guy in your life that you're going blind.
"Between these two genteel southern ladies, our family became an old west town. It just wasn't big enough for both of them."
Starring some familiar voices.
"Hey, this is Emmy Rossum."
"Hi, this is Jason Alexander."
"Hey, it's January Jones."
"Hey, it's Judd Apatow here."
Modern Love will make you laugh.
"Is everything all right up there?"
It'll make you cry.
"I started calling hospitals, then morgues."
It'll make you think.
"We can't keep calling you daddy," he said, "if you're gonna be a girl. It's too weird."
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and I'll be your host. Modern Love, the podcast, is a collaboration between The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. Stories of love, loss, and redemption.
"You're off the hook," I said. "No guilt."
"I love you. I love you too."
Modern Love, a new episode every Thursday. Subscribe today on iTunes and fall in love at first listen.